When the city of Chicago was being laid out, there was a man by the name of Daniel Burnham that was put in charge of that city, the design of it, to lay out and to present. And it's interesting that as Burnham presented the plans, there was a statement that was associated with him. And he said this: make no small plans. They have no power to stir men's souls. The idea that he had with this was a grand city that when people looked upon it, they would be impressed by it. And I suppose if you have been to Chicago, we might say at least that the old part of the city is rather impressive, the way that it was laid out. But the point I want us to see this morning with Burnham's quote is that there was another group of city planners who were right there with him on it. There were a group of people who said, we also want to build a city. And we want this city to be impressive. We want this city to be one that is going to get people's attention. But yet in their plans, in a very ominous way, what they sought to do was to thwart the ideas of God. That what God had told them to do, they said, we are not going to do by the construction of this city. This morning I want us to talk about this city of Babel, this city of confusion. And I want us to understand where the people went wrong in their ideas with that, not just simply to look at their story, not just simply to see the problems that they had, but rather to look and to see the dangers that we also face today. Because I believe many times, like the people of Babel, we can fall to the same temptations they did as we look at the things that we seek to accomplish in our lives. And so, as we consider what was just read to us concerning that city, keep those things in mind as we talk about this effort that they underwent and what we need to learn from what we might call Project Babel. Now let's travel back a way, way back in time to when this city was planned. We know that a great flood was the previous account we had just read of. That God had said, because of the wickedness of the world, I'm going to destroy all of mankind with the exception of Noah and his family. I'm going to destroy all of the animals with the exception of those that are brought in the ark. And I'm going to clean the place off and allow there to be a new beginning. And so that's exactly what Noah was allowed to do. God destroyed mankind, started anew with Noah and his sons. And as they left the ark and began this project that God had given them, God gave a very simple command. He said, when the flood is over, and when you go out, here is what I want of you. I want you to be fruitful and multiply and fill the whole earth. That was the instruction that was given to these eight souls. When we come to the account of Babel, I don't know how long after the flood we're talking about. If you do reading, you can find a lot of people who are guessing about it. I opened one book and it said, well, at least 1,000 years had gone by. I looked at several other sources and they said it's probably more like 100 years. I tend to side more with the shorter period of time. But I want you to think about this, that it's not an unlikely thought that the flood was at least still in the working memory of these people. Whether or not they had seen it is beside the point. They most likely, though, had parents or grandparents who had witnessed all of this destruction, who had come from those eight souls, and they understood because they came about shortly after the flood had ended. And so with that, we understand that these people knew why the command had been given. But what we also understand is that this people had said, we no longer accept the command. We no longer believe that this is something that God requires of us. And because of that, we have a different idea. We have a different plan that we're going to go by. And what that meant was that they were going to go in the direct opposite of God. So let's consider then why they sought to do what they did. Why did the people desire to do this Project Babel? Well, they had four aims. One of those, first of all, quite easily is seen here in the text, they wanted to build a city. And the second one, quite easy to see as well, they wanted to build a tower that stretched into the heavens. But let's look at the motivation behind this. Another of the aims that they had in this construction was they wanted to make a name for themselves. Pay particular attention to that. They wanted people to recognize them as somebody. They wanted people to see them as people who needed to be remembered. And the fourth of these, they did not want to scatter throughout the earth. What's very interesting is we look at this and we begin to see how directly opposed to God that they were. And I would say as we look at these four goals, that what we see really are two sins that are being committed in all of this. First of all, it had to do with the love of praise. The idea that we want people talking about us in a good way. We want to be put up on a pedestal. We want to be looked upon as role models for everyone. And the second thing that they saw was the love that they desired of security. The idea that we are going to be in a situation that nobody, nowhere can get to us. Nothing can cause problems for us. And because of these two temptations, these two sinful attitudes, it brings them then to construct this city and to construct this tower. So where do those two things fall in line with all of this? Well, we go back to that idea of building a city, and what we find with that was the protection against dispersion. The idea may have been that God said, we are going to be scattered, but they said, no, we're going to be right here together. We're going to build this metropolis for ourselves, and in this metropolis, we will all live together. And then we come to the part of the city that's most remembered. That idea of building a tower that's going to reach into the heavens. And I believe it's here that we see a people who say, we want to make a name for ourselves. Exactly what kind of name they wanted to make, I'm not sure. Lots of ideas are proposed. Some have said because of their ingenuity. I think that's a logical idea. People would come along maybe in future generations and they would look at this grand tower that stands in front of them and they would say, surely this was a brilliant people. Surely this was a people who was wise in engineering skills and constructing skills. And they've made this tower that 100, 200, 300 years is still standing as a testimony to who they are. Others have different opinions. A rather intriguing idea that some have is that these people very much knew about the flood. And they remembered either their parents or their grandparents or whomever telling them about how this flood covered the whole earth. And the idea being that they were going to build a tower that would thwart God's plans to ever destroy them by a flood. And perhaps on top of this tower that stretched into the heavens, if God ever got an idea like that again, they could just simply look out at the flood waters, but they were safe and sound up at the top. Some have even said that perhaps these are the first efforts in astrology, that since astrology does come from this region of the world, that maybe somehow this tower was going to be their kind of control of the universe, that they were looking to control it by recognizing the heavenly bodies. I don't know what they were trying to do. But I do know this, that they wanted to make a name for themselves. And whether that be in their brilliance, or whether that be in the thought that they could outsmart God, or whether that be in the creation of a new religion, whatever the case is, we know it was wrong. Because they were directly opposing God. And we ask ourselves why that came about. And I believe the answer to that question is the same answer that we find many times over. It's the idea of self-wisdom. The idea that I am smarter than God. The idea that although God has told me to do something, I really know better. And because I know better, I've got the liberty to leave God's plans behind. I think we find that fully within this account. And I believe that's one of the reasons that God has given us that. And as we look at the Tower of Babel, we understand that they failed because they were looking to themselves rather than to God. It's kind of interesting to make some contrast between the Tower of Babel and other places in the Bible. Here we find a people who want to make a name for themselves, who want to have control. Contrast that with something Jesus said many years later when he said it's actually the meek who are going to inherit the earth. The idea being that if you want to be right, if you want to have control, if you want to have power, it's the idea of submitting to God. It's a being on His side. But yet here are people who say, we're going to make a name for ourselves, we're going to be wise, when God says that wisdom is not found outside of me. He gives us so many illustrations of that within the pages of the Bible. People who say, I know better than you do. But I suppose perhaps one of the greatest illustrations from that is a lifelong project that was taken on by the writer of Ecclesiastes. Here was a man who was absorbed in that self-wisdom. Here was a man who said, I am going to seek to live my life without God, and I'm going to try everything I can to see where pleasure lies. I'm going to build up nice houses, and I'm going to bring in servants, and I'm going to have people around me who are laughing and who are playing instruments, and I'm going to try everything. And if you read through that very, very sad account, he finally gets it right. Over in Ecclesiastes chapter 12, as he reaches his grand conclusion of the book, I want us to note what he has to say here. After trying all of those things to try to find pleasure in his own wisdom, in his own ways, we come to verse 9 and he says, besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote the words of truth. These words of the wise are like goads and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these, of making many books there is no end, of much is a weariness of the flesh. And after all of that, what does he say? Verse 13, the end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments. For this is the whole duty of man. Listen to that. After all of the years of self-wisdom, after all of the misery, after all of the vanity, after all of the striving after the wind, he says to future generations, you don't have to write any more books, just read mine. I messed up all the way through, but the one thing I did understand is that true wisdom is found not in me and not in the things I can amass, but in God Himself. And that's what the people of Babel fail to understand. In fact, Solomon, as he actually writes one of the Psalms, had this to say within that Psalm, unless the Lord builds the house, Those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. What if the people of Babel had come to that understanding? To understand that if we try to build a city that the Lord doesn't watch over, we are vain. It's vanity, as the book of Ecclesiastes would say, it's a striving after the wind. That's all well and good for the people of Babel. But what about when it comes to us? Do we find ourselves falling into the same kind of temptations today? And I believe the answer to that is yes. That many times we find ourselves falling into the same traps. It may not be building a tower somewhere in a literal physical sense, but the idea that we're trying to build those same kind of towers within our lives. And so we think about that many times we have this outward show of pride and the trouble that it causes for us. We won't turn back to Daniel chapter 4, but let me just remind you what it says there. That's where King Nebuchadnezzar had just previously been warned, you're going to be brought down because of your pride. Daniel tells him this, interprets the message from God for him. Nebuchadnezzar looks out over the city of Babylon. And he says, what a wonderful city I have constructed. Taking all of the credit for all of the good that God had done for him, for himself. And it's at that point that God says, Nebuchadnezzar, you didn't listen to what I told you. Because of that, you'll be turned into an animal to go out and to graze in the fields until you learn who's in control. It's interesting, afterward, Nebuchadnezzar has quite a long speech recorded about who's in control. The recognition that it's God who runs things. The recognition that it is God whose wisdom is superior. But how many times do we find ourselves allowing things, allowing attitudes to become such a source of pride? We live in a time period that economists call a period of conspicuous consumption. The idea of that is we like to buy things that people see. We like to buy things that are very conspicuous. We like to buy things that are very impressive. And if we're not very careful, we can become just like the people of Babel. We want to make a name for ourselves because of what people are going to come by and see that we own. Whether that be a monstrous house, whether that be a terribly expensive automobile, whether that be the fine things that we fill our house with, whatever the case might be. How many times do we find ourselves building these towers by the fact that we are wanting people to look at us and to see what we have and to say that person must be somebody? Or maybe it's kind of like with King Nebuchadnezzar. The things being given to us by the Lord. Maybe sometimes it's not the conspicuous. Maybe it's the talents that we have. We're able to do something quite well by the grace of God. But God isn't given the credit for that. God is not brought into the equation and we start thanking people and we tell them how great we are and how hard we've had to work for these things. And deep down within ourselves, that pride begins to dwell up. Begins to rise within us because we're being recognized, because somebody has paid attention to us. Or maybe it's even the case of seeking to put others down so that we can be built up. If we find ourselves in a situation where somebody is kind of outshining us, we seek to put their lights out so that we can shine, whatever the case might be. And there's a long list of things we could add to it. Let's remember that such towers never stand. The kind of attitude that brought Babel to its conclusion will bring us to our conclusion. God simply will not allow it to stand. Well, let's talk about the other sinful attitude that they showed. And that was the bad decisions that were promoted because of those desires for security. The idea that we want to be in a situation where nothing's really going to bother us. Nothing's going to trouble us. That's very hard for a Christian. Because a Christian, quite honestly, is called on to do things that otherwise would be quite uncomfortable. If we took Christianity out of the equation, we might not ever do those things. But God says, if you're going to be a child of mine, security is found in trusting me. Often, however, we try to get to the point where we want to provide our own security. And maybe we want to do that even within the realms of Christianity. But rather than believing and trusting God, we begin pursuing our own ideas. And we know that we live in a time that is ripe with divorce and remarriage. And we know that if we hold to what the New Testament says, we are going to not be liked by a whole lot of folks. And so we begin to bend our attitudes a bit, to change our belief structure a little bit, not because we found corrections within the Bible, but because we like the security of people not looking at us as being kind of out of the mainstream. How much perhaps even more in recent months with the whole topic of homosexuality, where now we have the whole gay rights movement somehow being compared to the civil rights movement of the 1960s. And if we are not right there on board with gay rights and homosexual marriage, then we're kind of like the bigots who lived years ago. No. But yet there are people who say, maybe I'm wrong on this. Maybe though God has told me in several places within the Bible His view of changing the first relationship He gave to man and woman, maybe I've been wrong. Maybe I need to change. Not because I've found it within the Word, but because of the security of being more of a blended in part of society. We could go on, couldn't we? With so many other things. We could think about the role of a local church, as we'll deal with this evening. We could talk about all kinds of things, but it's the idea that we want that security. Well, let me tell you, if we start changing our plans to meet what we desire rather than what God wants, Christianity just simply becomes a security blanket for us. It's not that we're following God. It's not that we're seeking to do His will. It's just simply the idea that we can console ourselves at night and say, well, I'm a Christian, even though I've changed all of these things, and at least that'll make me feel okay. That didn't go so well for the people of Babel. When they started changing the plans of God, things went down in a hurry for them. And I assure you that it will for us as well. I want us to understand that when we start feeling that way, when we start feeling rather insecure, it's important for us to think about what God has told people of other times when they started feeling insecure. I think about Jeremiah the prophet over in chapter 1. To say that Jeremiah was jumping for joy at the prospects of being a prophet would be quite wrong. He was trying to talk God out of it, as a matter of fact. But I want you to know what the Lord says to him here in verse 17. He says, "But you, dress yourself for work. Arise and say to them everything that I command you. Do not be dismayed by them, lest I dismay you before them. And I, behold, I will make you this day a fortified city, an iron pillar and bronze walls against the whole land, against the kings of Judah, its officials, its priests, and the people of the land. They will fight against you, but they shall not prevail against you. For I am with you, declares the Lord, to deliver you." That's what we need to believe. That when we look at what God says, and even though that may promote feelings of insecurity amongst us, when those feelings arise, we look at what God told Jeremiah. And when He said, they are going to fight against you, but I'll be with you. And if I'm with you, that's all you need. We must beware of the temptations that plagued Babel, and we must overcome them. And I would say also, we need to understand that God's plans will not be stopped. That's what these people failed to understand, I believe. They thought that they could do whatever they wanted, and God, for whatever reason, perhaps was not going to be able to stop them. But that is not the case, because the Lord is going to thwart the plans that they had to do away with His commands. And you remember what happens. God says, I'm going to go down and I'm going to confuse their languages, and they will confuse their language into many, and they will not be able to communicate, and they will understand that I am the one who's running this, that I am the one who's in control. The Lord saw that what they were doing was only the beginning of wickedness. When He says, if they do this, I'm paraphrasing, they'll be able to do anything, He's not saying that they could take His power away. What He's saying is they'll be able to do anything in pursuing their wicked courses. They'll go in all manner of directions with this. And because He knew that, He made the decision to stop it. And so this plan of a one world government that was going to diminish God from the picture was stopped very quickly after it was begun. And the people, because of their attitudes and their language here being changed, their attitudes had to change as well. And this God-belittling plan was ended. I want us to understand for us also that when we think about God's plans, it's not going to be stopped by those who ignore it. We may look around and see the world around us and say, things are just going so poorly. How can God let this happen? God is just kind of letting wicked take control and to take over. I can assure you that God has it all under control, and that God has a plan, and that His plan will prevail. And we're not the first people to be thinking that kind of thing. I want you to look very quickly with me over to 2 Peter chapter 3. And as we look at 2 Peter chapter 3, there were others who were saying similar things as we look down to verse 3 of the chapter. Peter says, "Knowing this first of all, that scoffers will come in the last days with scoffing, following their own sinful ways, they will say, 'Where is the promise of His coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all things are continuing as they were from the beginning of creation.'" You wonder if perhaps the people of Babel may have felt that way. Well, where is God now? We've not seen the great signs and miracles of the past. Where is He now? We'll do things our way. And Peter says, that is exactly what false teachers teach you. They say, forget about the things of God. God's gone to sleep. God's gone away. God's dead. God never existed. Because things continue as they always have. Peter goes on to say, be careful of that, because one day the Lord will come and His plan will be fully implemented. And so if you and I are ever tempted in this postmodernist mindset that the commands of God really don't matter, that we can do whatever we desire to do, we think about this passage in 2 Peter and we think about what happened at Babel. And I want to make another point to you about this. God also often works to save us from ourselves. I think that's what He was doing at Babel. Here were a people who were heading in the wrong direction. And so God said, let me scatter you so that you can actually go in the right direction. And I believe God does that. Perhaps not that overtly always. But yet God works to keep us from getting an idea or continuing down a path that may very well lead to a bad conclusion for us. We think about what the writer of Hebrews tells us in chapter 12, verses 10 and 11. When he said about earthly fathers, they disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to them, but He disciplines us for our good, that we may share His holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Sometimes God puts a stop to our plans. As I said, I don't know that we always know when that happens. I don't know that we always understand when God is working in that way. But when God sees us heading in a wrong direction, like the people of Babel, He may very well work to save us from that wrong direction by changing those plans. And I would say one other thing that we need to consider with this idea is that nothing is going to stop Him. And I'll just remind you of what Isaiah said about that. When the Lord said, "My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." Anytime we start getting the Babel Project mentality, we need to stop and remember this. God has a plan, and that plan is perfect, whether we understand it or not. And we need to follow that plan. As we think about all of these things and bring our thoughts to a conclusion, I'd like to remind you of one other thing. God's plans can also remove us from confusion. Whole Tower of Babel, Babel meaning confusion, the idea is He created that to stop them. But we also understand that God can bring us to the right way. And there's a very interesting contrast we might note over in Acts chapter 2 that also deals with languages. Back in Genesis, we find all of these languages being scattered and changed. But we look to Acts chapter 2, day of Pentecost. Verse 1 says, "The day of Pentecost arrived. They were all together in one place, and suddenly there came from heaven a sound like a mighty rushing wind, and it filled the entire house where they were sitting. And divided tongues as a fire appeared to them and rested on each one of them. And they were filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak in other tongues as the Spirit gave them utterance. Now there were dwelling in Jerusalem Jews, devout men from every nation under heaven. And at the sound of the multitude came together, and they were bewildered because each one was hearing them speak in his own language." I want you to think about that for a minute. Here in Genesis, we find God confusing the languages. And here in Acts, God is giving a uniting message in every language so that these people could become one in Jesus Christ. And the grand irony of all of this is this, that God had a plan to unite men. But it was on His terms. It was on His schedule. And it was going to be His plan. And that plan meant that men would not be united in the heavens in some tower. They would be united in heaven with God by His plan and none other. And basically what it all boils down to is this, is how much you trust that plan of God. Which best describes us? The people who on the plains of Shinar set out on their own course, or a people who hear that gospel message presented right now in their own language, who say, I want to follow? Whose plan are you trusting? Your own or the Lord's?